Good evening, everyone. Welcome back to Polita Talk with Tanbir, with your host, Tanbir. This episode is my second special interview episode. I am honored to host with Wyoming U.S. Senate candidate, Yana Ludwig. Yana, thank you so much for joining today. I'm very honored. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing all right. We're having a windy and sunny day here in Wyoming. It's lovely.
All right. It's pretty hot here. In New York City. So, you know, we're bringing out the ACs now, right about now. So before we start, do you mind telling the listeners a little bit about yourself?
Sure. So I am, you know, I have mostly spent my life working in the nonprofit sector and living in residential intentional communities where I've done a lot of work around creating sustainable systems and looking at social dynamics and whatnot. And these days, I split my work time between writing and doing a lot of training and consulting around cooperative culture development and basically having groups function well, which makes it very ironic that I'm running to be a U.S. senator where the dynamics are absolutely horrible.
Chaotic, right? If you don't mind me asking, what is it that you write?
Well, my last book was called Together Resilient, Building Community in the Age of Climate Disruption. And so it was really focused on locally self-governed and self-managed responses to climate disruption. So things like, you know, urban community gardens projects and local currency projects and the kinds of intentional communities and eco-villages that I've lived in. So really any kind of way that, you know, people on the grassroots can be changing their lives and organizing directly to address climate issues. And there's also a chapter in that book that is specifically around economic and legal reform, where I have a platform that's pretty close to what people are now calling the Green New Deal, you know, pretty holistic and, you know, looking at things like racial and economic equity, as well as things that are going to reduce our carbon footprints.
All right. That's interesting. I'm definitely looking forward to finding that book and reading it. I didn't know that. Thank you.
Yeah.
So you're running to replace the seat of senior Wyoming Senator Mike Enzi, a Republican who's held that position since 1997. Mm-hmm. And you're in a pretty crowded race. There's six Democrats amongst yourself running and 10 Republicans running as well. So I don't think, before I ask, I'm going to ask another question. Is this a runoff style election or?
No, it's a, we'll have one Democratic nominee and one Republican nominee.
All right. So that brings me to my next point. The pool is going to go from 16 to 2 after August 18, the day of the primary. You're facing off five Democrats. What makes you the right Democratic candidate over the others?
Well, I think the number one thing is that I'm the most progressive and also have the deepest policy platform in terms of, you know, there's a few candidates in there that are pretty single issue and, you know, they're running on legalizing marijuana, for instance. And where I'm running on legalizing marijuana, I'm also running on a whole bunch of other stuff. And,
right.
You know, my background is really in listening for a living and in things like policy development that is really responsive to people's actual needs. And I'm very much a, you know, I'm working class, I'm queer, I'm, you know, connected with a whole bunch of communities that don't have representation, you know, certainly in Wyoming and, you know, in a lot of places in the United States, you know, a lot of us haven't really ever had solid representation. And I think it's the combination of my skills and my particular political orientation that make me the best candidate for this job.
Right. So you brought up that you're queer. I wanted to bring that up as well. You are the only candidate in Wyoming who's running for a statewide office that is openly queer. As a Democrat, if you do win the primaries, which I personally hope for, last night, West Virginia, Paula Jean won hers first.
Yes.
Progressive too.
Yes.
Yeah, I was excited. That was good. That was great news. So, you know, hopefully you join that boat as well. So if you do win the primaries, the Democratic ticket in the general election will be led by Joe Biden. He's been around for decades and he's voted for the controversial Defense of Marriage Act. And in the 2008 VP debates, he agreed with his opponent, Sarah Palin, against LGBTQ marriage equality. He's been against it up until his second term as vice president when it seemed politically convenient. How do you see yourself working working with that, working on the ticket that he leads?
Well, I mean, you know, I think there's a really interesting thing right now with both the Democratic and the Republican parties where I feel like there's some very deep splits in the parties. And, you know, like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez recently said, like, you know, Joe Biden and I shouldn't really be in the same party to some extent. I really see myself being, you know, in that slice of the Democratic Party that Bernie Sanders and AOC and Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib has sort of opened space up for someone like me to run as a viable candidate. And, you know, I addressed the Wyoming Democratic State Convention this past weekend. And one of the things that I said is that I don't think it's enough to say, I'm going to go to DC to take on the Republicans. I think what we need to be willing to do is to take on our own party as well as the Republicans when they're wrong and to work with both parties when they're right. And there are moments where I think, you know, there's people on both sides of the aisle that are looking at doing the right things. But I don't really have any illusions about, you know, moderate Democrats or corporate Democrats or, you know, however you want to frame it, being excited about a candidacy like mine.
Right. I definitely do agree because, you know, the Democratic Party is split. And I personally think that Joe Biden is lucky his opponent is Donald Trump. Otherwise, he wouldn't have a lot of the support he does have now. So I wanted to ask you, do you have any internal polling data or anything like any trajectory relating to your race?
We don't. No. I mean, there, as far as I know, there's been no polling. For the only polling that happened was a theoretical matchup between Cynthia Lummis and Liz Cheney back when Liz Cheney was still trying to decide whether she was going to run for the House again or the Senate. And as far as you know, there hasn't been any other polling for this race at all.
Oh, wow. All right. We can only hope Election Day works in your favor. So another hypothetical, if you are to win the primary, Wyoming is a state that provided Donald Trump his largest victory margin in 2016. The senior and junior senators of Wyoming are Republican. The governor is a Republican. How do you pitch your progressive Democratic campaign and policies to the heavy Republican population of the state? How do you win them over?
Well, I think the number one thing that we're doing is we are reaching out to people who are normally very neglected by the political process. And in Wyoming, there's three primary groups that we're doing strong outreach to, and not just like sort of normal politician outreach, but actually really listening and really making sure that we're leading with policies that are going to be good for them in their lives. And so one of those groups is workers, low wage workers. And, you know, so we're reaching out directly to people who work at Walmart, people who work in fast food, hotel workers, you know, folks that I had a really interesting interaction with a hotel worker earlier in the campaign, like when we were still traveling around the state and, you know, she was, you know, cleaning rooms. And I, you know, and I walked over to her and said, like, hey, can I talk to you for a second? I'm running for U.S. Senate. Here's a little bit of information. My platform is leading with workers' rights. And she was like, why are you even talking to me? I mean, she just couldn't believe that a U.S. Senate candidate was actually taking the time to have a real conversation with her. And we talked for about 20 minutes. And then she took a stack of my information and said, you know, I'll share this out with a bunch of people. I just can't believe you're even talking to me. And so so that's one of the groups. The second group is young people. You know, I mean, Wyoming is, you know, not that different than a lot of places where young people are feeling very disenfranchised and, you know, across party lines are actually much more open to things like socialism and, you know, are much more matter of fact about the fact that queer people exist and, you know, that kind of stuff. And so so that second group is young people, and we have a dedicated full-time youth caucus organizer on our campaign. And then the third group is people with disabilities. And they are often the most neglected in elections. And, you know, we have a situation right now where the Americans with Disabilities Act has never been fully implemented. And there's a whole host of other issues. The fact that a lot of people with disabilities are exempted from minimum wage laws, for instance. So there's a whole host of things where, you know, I've really leaned strongly into having a disability rights platform. And it's partly because I have a chronic illness and I, you know, was disabled for several years. I fortunately have that under control at this point. But a lot of people, you know, don't get that opportunity to sort of heal what's going on with them, and they're dealing with disability their entire life. And so that's a constituency that is very near and dear to my heart and that I've done very active outreach with. And so our plan is basically to turn out people who don't normally vote, and also to be proposing things that are really have broad appeal across party lines. And so one of those is that last week we released a public banking proposal for the state of Wyoming. And the only other state that has a public bank right now is North Dakota, which is hardly a bastion of liberalism. Right. The public bank is very popular there. And we've gotten interest from state legislators who are Republicans in talking to us about that. And so, you know, we're really trying to show up and be helpful and not just be a candidate, but actually be a force for positive change within the state while we're doing the campaign, and to be doing that pretty unique outreach. So that's our approach, and we'll see where that lands us.
All right. That is a good plan. I like that. Because again, you know, disability, people with disabilities, that's definitely a demographic that's left out far too much. So I wanted to ask you next on a few things policy-wise. One is relating to current events right now. You know, George Floyd, these protests happening all around. Where do you stand on the social justice police reform and defunding platform?
Yeah, well, one of the things to know about my background that I didn't mention is that I'm one of the founding members of an organization called Albany County for Proper Policing, which was a police violence advocacy group in my county. We have one of the deadliest cops in the country in our county, who's on the sheriff's, you know, part of the sheriff's department, and killed a mentally ill Latino man about a year and a half ago. And that was when ACOP came about. And so I was a founding member of that group. So that's an issue that I've been active with locally here all along. I'm pretty close to a police abolitionist. I think that local communities ought to be able to define for themselves what public safety looks like and what the systems that support public safety look like. And I'm pretty darn sure it's not going to look like the current policing that we have right now. And so I'm going to be leaving right from this interview to head downtown for, we've been in the streets for, this will be our 10th day in a row in Laramie, protesting specifically that person still being employed. But, you know, I am very strongly in favor of defunding the police and seriously revisioning what our communities need on the ground.
Right. To add on to that, you know, some police departments, including my own NYPD, they tried to take on that community policing approach to address the whole what communities have different needs thing, but evidently it's not sufficing. So, you know, it just isn't. So yeah, there's that. And I also wanted to ask you, do you believe that Citizens United and Super PACs should be abolished and overturned so that campaign fundraising could be solely reliant on public funding and grassroots donors?
Absolutely.
Right. Yeah. Because, you know, special interests, it's all around. It's not just a Republican issue. Two sad leaders, Democrats, right, taking super PACs. Amy McGrath has a super PAC in Kentucky. So Medicare for All and a Green New Deal. I know you brought those up. You wrote a book. You said, mentioned earlier, that laid out very similarly to the Green New Deal. Both are major policies that you're for, but the Republican Party is strongly against it, and many Democratic colleagues are against it as well. And again, Joe Biden is against Medicare for All. So, and then one of the most progressive senators there right now, co-author of the Green New Deal, Ed Markey, is facing a tough primary race. So it seems to be the less favorable stance in Congress. If you are if you don't just win the primaries, but if you win the general too, and you're elected to the Senate, how would you get your colleagues to co-sponsor and pass those two pieces of legislation?
Well, I think one of the key things here is that I think one of the mistakes that the Democrats consistently make at the federal level is that they start from a compromised position. You know, they say, well, we're never going to be able to get a single-payer healthcare thing passed, so we're not going to ask for it. And then what we actually end up getting is significantly compromised from what people are actually wanting. And so I think it's important that we go in and that we have some people in both the Senate and the House who are planting a really firm flag in the ground and saying, like, no, I'm asking for single payer. This is what I'm advocating for. And this is why. And I think that there's a lot of good, you know, logical reasons for those people in the House and Senate who are swayed by, you know, logic and reason. I think you can get them on your side with this stuff. And with those other things, those other folks, I think that we just need to be starting, not compromising ourselves right at the get-go. Now, the Green New Deal is an interesting one because I think that there are bits and pieces of it that I think could have broad appeal across parties. And I think that's getting more and more true every year. And, you know, if I go in, one of the reasons that I'm running for the Senate seat and not the House seat, is that it does give us 6 years to work before having to go through all of the effort that goes into getting elected again. And I'd like to go in and be a very stable presence advocating for both of those things and then watch the Senate catch up with me, which is what I think would happen over the course of those 6 years. But I think that only really happens if you have some people that are willing to ask for what we actually want.
So a follow-up question to that, yes or no answer, you could explain your answer as well. For the sake of passing the Green New Deal or Medicare for All, would you resort to filibustering?
You know, I don't know. I have deeply mixed feelings about the filibuster. I think that when your party is out of power, it is a valuable tool. It's kind of like what senators have in the form of kind of civil disobedience. And then there's other times where it's like it's clearly used in ways that are not for the people and are really just trying to throw a wrench into the works for getting progressive stuff passed. So I don't know. I could see myself using the filibuster every once in a while. But it's not like it's kind of a distasteful practice to me as somebody who cares about good process. But I also recognize that I'm going into playing much more of a competitive game and not as much of a cooperative one as I'm oriented toward generally. So I don't really know the answer to that, Tembir. I mean, maybe, which is no answer. I'm sorry.
No, don't worry about it. Again, the filibuster is controversial for a reason. It highly depends on which side of the Senate you're sitting in as
When we
well.
do it, and we don't like it when they do it, and like,
Exactly.
great.
Vice
That's
versa.
the
So to delve into Medicare for All, why do you support that over just, there's a lot of Democratic leaders who don't want Medicare for All. They just want to build up on Obamacare, as they say. Why do you favor Medicare for All and not that?
Well, I think it's important that we move to a single payer system because if we leave private insurance companies in the mix, there's going to be a couple of things that will happen. I mean, one of those is that they have no reason to continue offering insurance for people who, you know, have long-term conditions like I do. And I think that those people will just get dumped into the public system and we're the expensive people to take care of. And so I think leaving that dual tracking in place is a setup for the public system failing, basically, and for it being every Republican's nightmare around it being incredibly expensive. You know, insurance companies know that it is more healthy people participating in the system that give them their profits. And in our case, I think it would be that more healthy people being in the system would make it really affordable for the government and for everybody. And so that is one of the reasons. The other thing is that I just have a fundamental distaste for two-tier systems and for single-class citizenship. And I feel like if we have these variations based on how much money you make for something that is a fundamental human right, access to good healthcare, then, you know, I think that there's some moral and ethical issues with that. You know, I also think that it's going to be much more affordable if we get private insurance out of the country. Right now, about 40% of the money that Americans spend on healthcare isn't on healthcare at all. It's on private insurance. And they basically just act as gatekeepers. You know, they get to tell you who you can see, when you can see them, what kinds of care you can get. And I don't think private insurance provides any actual value to anybody.
Right. And, you know, it's the way healthcare works here. It's very flawed. People need GoFundMe pages because they can't afford medications. And then, you know, the private pharmaceuticals, they patent certain medications. So that way it's just theirs to make profits off of, which is why insulin here costs way more than it would in Canada per vial. So, you know, Obamacare leaves a lot of people out of it. That's where the popularity for Medicare for All came in. A lot of Democrats are refusing to vote for Joe Biden until he pledges to advocate for Medicare for All. Because, you know, he's not even just against it. He's not even just neutral on it. He just says he's going to veto it if it ever comes to him. So he has no interest in working towards it. So thank you for explaining that. And do you have any other final message for tonight's episode that you want to send out about your campaign?
Well, one of the issues that we kind of talked around the edges of a little bit with the police violence issue is racial justice issues. And, you know, I just want to name another couple pieces that are really important to me, which is reparations and treaty rights and tribal sovereignty. And I think both of those things are really critical. Like, until we actually reckon with our racist history as a nation and bring our practices into alignment with the belief that all people are, you know, deserve a life of dignity, deserve a life of opportunity, then I think we are seriously compromised as a nation and will be until we do that reckoning. And so I think those policy pieces are critically important for us to be looking at as well.
Right. And then as far as reparations go, that's an even more rare policy than Medicare for All and Green New Deal, because, you know, in the presidential debates, Tom Steyer was one of the only ones, him and Marion Williamson were the only ones, I believe, who advocated for reparations, $200 to $500 billion.
Yeah, there's a whole package of things that will benefit everyone and, you know, would particularly benefit people of color. And, you know, and those are issues around economic justice, and those aren't good enough. I mean, I think that, you know, I was a strong supporter of Bernie Sanders, and I still am. And I think he misses the boat in not pairing together his amazing economic agenda with also some explicit racial justice agenda. So I think we need both in tandem with each other.
Right. I agree with that. Thank you very much, Yana, for your time. It was a wonderful opportunity to sit and have this interview with you. That concludes this PolitiTalk with Tambir interview. To the folks listening, be sure to visit Yana's campaign website at yanaforwile.com and follow her on Twitter at forwile. It'll be in the bio to spell out and refer to. Follow me on Twitter at It's Tambir C to subscribe to PolitiTalk on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. It's greatly appreciated. Again, Yana, thank you very much. It was a wonderful opportunity. I wish you the best of luck, and I will be on the lookout for your election. You know, let's hope it works in favor, of course. Join Paula in the general.
Well, thank you so much for having me on. I appreciate it.
No problem. I hope you and your family have a great and safe remaining week, and I hope everyone out there is the same as well.